Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale. Coming up next on the Wet Fly Swing Podcast.
If you go outside and you cast and you have your thumb up when you cast and you push the rod forward on your forward stroke, you push it and you don't tip it down a little bit, you will throw a tail. If you separate the top and the bottom a little bit by just tipping your thumb down, kind of like when you throw a dart and your thumbnail ends up pointing at where you threw the dart, if you're doing this with your hand right now, which I am, you can force yourself to throw a tail. When you can do that and you do this kind of punch-push thing with your thumb up, you'll throw a tail, you will begin to understand how you threw a tailing loop.
That was JP Ross with his best tip for understanding the dreaded tailing loop. Skinny Streams, ESPN Outdoors, and Trout Power, today on The Swing.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the show. A quick and easy way to support this podcast is to click over through our sponsors' links. Go over there, give them a shout out, let them know you found them through this podcast. And if you get a chance and find a product you like, go ahead and check it out. Click that buy button. We would appreciate all that support. This episode is sponsored by Rare Gear, not only making telescoping fly rods, but rethinking the whole fly fishing kit as we know it. This rod is a blend of traditional and Tenkara styles to make a super highly packable rod that fits literally in your pocket. I have this thing going everywhere with me. It's in my backpack. It's always there. Throwing it down, you sometimes forget about it, but when you need it, you can break it out and fold that thing out in a matter of seconds, and you're good to go. We're also sponsored by Angler's Coffee, roasting a full range of coffees with one goal in mind, delivering excellent coffee to every single angler. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/anglers right now to support anglers and this podcast. That's Anglers, A-N-G-L-E-R-S. JP Ross is here to share his fishing story of creating a 30-year-old fly rod company and some of the great mentors he's had along the way. We hear about one of those mentors, Berkheimer, who early on helped him connect and enroll some of his blanks. And we find out what his favorite length is for small streams. It is definitely on the small side, and we dig into that today. And we also find out about his podcast he created, In the Seam. Give a holler if you have time today. So without further ado, here we go. JP from jprossflyrods.com. How's it going, JP?
It's going great, Dave. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for putting this together today. Sometimes probably like you, you have a podcast going, you've got a business going, you're probably a pretty busy guy, and sometimes I wonder, exactly where these episodes start from. But I think I realized as I was getting into it that Mark Usyk is a friend of yours, right?
Yes, very close friend of mine. We've been together since first grade Catholic school.
Oh, wow. So there you go. So I didn't know, and I knew, I've been hearing about you out there. You've been popping around, but I'm sure Mark has mentioned you or along the way, because I know he's been supporting what we have going here, for a while. And, so I think that's probably the connection we have, but you've got some good stuff going here. So I want to talk about your fly rods. Of course, the podcast is exciting that you have that going, In the Seam podcast. And then, but starts off, before we jump into a little, we're also going to dig into some on small stream fishing, but bring us right back quickly to how you got into fly fishing. We'll take it into the rods.
I got into fly fishing when I was probably around 12 years old or so. And it's an interesting story. I went to my mother's work. she managed a doctor's office, and Dr. Lombardo was one of her clients that she managed. She did like office administration and ran the business essentially for a bunch of doctors. And anyway, he always asked, you know, hey, are you doing any fishing? And I told him that I was saving my money to buy this Fenwick spinning rod. And he was like, spinning rod, you know? And he's like, you know, you need to learn to fly fish. And I was like, I was 12 years old. And I was like, I don't know what that, you know, that stuff's all about. And so he literally canceled an appointment that afternoon, took me outside to his old Suburban. It was the old Chevy platform where they were like the kind of like the mini school bus type, you know?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
That's so awesome. And it was dark blue and white stripe. I remember that. And he had like the bus doors on the back, and he opened it up and he taught me how to fly cast in the parking lot.
Nice.
And I in turn did get a Fenwick Eagle fly rod. It was my first fly rod. And I would walk to the local creek, and I'd walk to the Dunham Public Library, and I got all kinds of books, read as much as I could. And then by the time I got to 16, it was like I was fishing. And when I was in high school, I was already doodling logos for the fly rod company and fly shop. I mean, I was like, I knew I was going to do it. So,
yeah. That's right. Wow. So that's, I mean, that is a cool story. I love that, the doctor. And I just talked to one of our listeners this week who is also a doctor. I kind of occasionally try to pick the brain of some of our listeners when I can. And yeah, it's pretty cool, right? I mean, you've got all these people around here that typically there's one person that you hear that gets you going on it. And, And so the rod, so how'd you talk about that a little bit? So you already know you're doodling in high school. I mean, what did that translate? What was that like going from that period into now where you are?
Well, so in high school, I had an auto detailing business. So I was like, kind of like cut my teeth into entrepreneurship, like young. So a lot of people are afraid to leap to do a business. And I wasn't that afraid to do it. I just needed some funding to do it. And I saved a lot of money. Actually, I saved up tens of thousands of dollars in order to have the first fly shop, which was called Rising Trout Outfitter. It was on the third floor of a old textile mill that got refurbished into offices. And as soon as I got into the fly shop, of course, you know, the reps start showing up. So the Thomas & Thomas rep shows up and the Sage rep shows up. And yeah. I remember that, you know, I was like, oh my God, like these are like $300 entry level fly rods, you know? And I'm like, first of all, I got to buy these at wholesale. Secondly, I don't know if anyone's really going to buy these. So I always wanted to make my own, never really did it. And just carved out a spot in the shop and started making JP Ross fly rods. And the whole idea was I was making a rod that was $100 retail with a case. And I could make more margin doing that than buying, I guess the entry level stuff from the big guys. And what ended up happening was, you know, I learned a lesson in business too, which is, you know, your customer relationships and standing up for your product and being there for your customers. So many people wanted another one. They got the basic one, and then they would say, you know, I want another one. I want a nicer one. So I said, okay, I'll make another one. I'll make a nicer version. And it grew. And then you know, the stigma of having a quote unquote rod company is, are they your blanks? You know? So eventually it got to the point where I teamed up with at the time, I teamed up with Kerry Berkheimer, and he was like the first guy that took me serious, and we made and designed some rods together. I also teamed up with a guy named Eric Jobson who had, he was rolling blanks up near Lake Placid, and had my own designs and learned about batch process, because you know, you'd make a dozen of them and, you know, six or so would be like really good. I don't know if people know this, but you know, when you roll blanks and make your own blanks, they're not all identical. It is a batch process, and they're, you know, so, you know, some flex good, some don't flex good. So that kind of got me into realizing what you had to do to do your own designs and how much you had to invest. And eventually that morphed into, I had a great team of anglers that wanted to compete in the ESPN outdoor games. And they happened to be at Lake Placid. A lot of them were at Lake Placid, which is not far from us, where the 1980 Olympics were. And we designed a rod called the K357. And many of the people for a few years competed and cast my rod and was winning the casting competitions. We won it too. I ended up kind of like being the guy in the background, you know, that was like, I wasn't the tall, handsome, great casting guy. I was the guy behind the scenes that was envisioning, what we should do to the rods and who should be casting them and what our message should be. And this is all in my late 20s. So I started when I was 20, and then in my late 20s, it really took off. And that's where we kind of morphed into small stream rods too.
Oh, gotcha. So late 20s. And what, just for time-wise, so you started, I think, the rod company in 97. So late 20s was what year was that?
So late 20s was early 2000s. So I was 20 in 97. So in 2007, yeah. I was 30.
Gotcha. Perfect. All right. So that gives us a little time frame. And Berkheimer, I love that. Obviously, he's huge. We had him on episode 282. We'll put a link in the show notes to that. He builds one of the best. And so that's pretty amazing. I mean, how do you connect with somebody like Berkheimer? You know, because I'd imagine a lot of people would love to connect with him. I've heard I think he talked about that in the episode, that he did some of that stuff with other folks out there. How'd that work?
Yeah, I don't think Carrie does it anymore. I think he focuses pretty much on his own stuff, which is great. But, you know, it's a small niche community, and there weren't, at the time, there really weren't like a lot of people that were rolling graphite. And even then, I will tell you, like, it was, I saw the transition of stuff from Asia. You know, when I started, that wasn't the case. In the late 90s, everything was still pretty much like OEM. Was made by the original manufacturer, and it was made where their headquarters was. So then we went through this transition of people that are, you know, are an American company, but they're getting components from Asia. And then that kind of like, you know, now recently with COVID and everything, that's kind of like changed, you know, you have to deal with supply chain stuff and everything. Yeah. So Carrie was just through networking, and it was a small group. So, and he just really was, it was, there were a lot of people in my history that were, you know, older, seasoned, craftsmen, business people that took me seriously. And I was this kind of young guy. There were a lot of people that wanted to see me fail too. Cause the market, the industry is, any industry is like that, right? You got sincere people that really are doing it for one reason, and then there's always a group of people that really are just, you know, protective, kind of crotchety, right. You know, snotty, want you to fail, you know.
It seems to me like, I don't know, I don't even know, but it seems like that's the minority. I know we had another rod builder on, Oyster Bamboo, and he talked about how he created this school to teach people how to do it. And everybody, you know, was like trying to hide their secrets in the bamboo, but he was like, you know what, I'm just going to share it with everybody. And that actually helped his business. You know,
sure.
I feel like the people that are kind of holding it tight, I don't know. It just seems like, again, I always compare it to what we do in the podcasting. I feel like the more fly fishing podcasts out there, the better we will be. Right. I think it raises everybody. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. So along the way, you ran into a few people that were kind of like, you know, hoping you weren't successful around 30 years later.
That's not necessarily the fly fishing industry. That's capitalism.
Yeah.
You know, when you start to grow and you start to be considered possibly a threat to whoever is your nearest competition, you're going to find out really quick, you know, what the behavior is of that competitor. And it doesn't matter if you're a baker, you're a, you know, craft brewery, you know, whatever it is. Suddenly, you know, the craft brewer gets a label and decides, you know, they're going to start selling to like the local grocery market. And then the big brewery's like, who's this guy? You know,
yeah.
Do they want to team up with them? Do they want to put them out of business? You know, that's just capitalism.
Yeah.
So you got to be, you know, and to your point about like all the podcasts and stuff like that, I will say that, you know, today's day and age of doing business, there's a lot of saturation of stuff. So, you know, trying to be able to be seen and heard and have an interesting message, a unique message, is a challenge. It's not as, you know, it's not as easy maybe as it was back in the late 90s when there weren't as many players. Now there's a lot of players. So it's challenging. You got to really be deliberate about what your vision is and how you're going to execute that vision. You have to be agile so that you can learn from, I don't want to say failures, because I hate the word failure, because failure, in my opinion, is giving up. There's just lessons that you learn when things don't go to plan, and you just pivot.
Yeah.
You know? So
that's right. That's right. Yeah. Pivot, being good at, I like failure. I like that word because I think it, you know, I think it's good. I think there's quotes out there, right? Those that fail most are the ones that win, stuff like that, you know, because you get good at it, because you're going to, you know, out of the things, like whether you're talking about marketing or business, I mean, you know, 80% of the things you try are not going to work out, but it's those 20% that do work, and then you double down on those. No, this is great, man. Well, I feel like we could chat again. Like we said at the start, I could talk to you about business for an hour easily, but let's keep it on track here, because you mentioned a couple things. Yeah. And, so the Berkheimer is interesting to me, you know, because he's such a big player, and it makes sense now, you know, why you're still in the game, obviously having some of those influences early. So now where you're at now, I mean, so you've been, how many years has the Rod Company been going?
25.
Strong? 25. And then you started that fly shop. Now is that still rolling as well?
No, I got the, I don't know if you can swear on here, but you know, I got the,
go for it.
Yeah. Well, I got the shit kicked out of me in 2006, which was when, I don't even know if you know who Gander Mountain is, but there was a local Gander Mountain came to town. They opened up their big box store. That took a lot of my local market share. I wasn't smart enough to be expanding the fly rod company to the bigger market, although I did have dealers at the time. And it just took too much top line revenue too quickly. And I regret now that I didn't dig my heels in. I was kind of a baby. Like, you know, I kind of like was, you know, poor me. And went into to doing some corporate work. And, you know, I regret that. I should have, whatever. I'm not going to shit on myself.
Yeah.
That's what happened. So I closed the fly shop, kept the rod company, scaled down. And then I did do what I am doing now, which is I pivoted and sold, and now I sell direct. I have one dealer, really. I have one dealer, which is Andrew O'Neill in Laramie, Wyoming, the company called Free Flow. And Andrew's from here, local. I've made a couple documentary films with Andrew. He started this archery fly shop in Laramie, and you can buy my rods at his shop. Otherwise, everything's direct. And the reason for that is because it's not because of the margins. It's because of my purpose of why I exist as a company. And my purpose is to interact with people and try to be to have an effect in their life, to get outside and enjoy the outdoors, and that the fly rod is just a tool, right? A fly rod, an archery bow, hiking boots, a canoe, they're just tools that haunt you to be used. And I'm trying to make this tool that is haunting my customers, which hope to be friends, go outside.
That's great. What is that? I'm thinking now the River Runs Through It quote, right? I mean, it was, you started your company right about the river runs through it. Haunted. I'm haunted by waters.
Yeah.
That was the quote at the end. You know, I'm haunted by waters. It's like, that's a pretty powerful word when you hear that, right?
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, in the case of, you know, Norman McLean, there's a double entendre to him being haunted, right? He was haunted on the water because he would think, I personally believe the reason he used those words is not only is he haunted by waters to go beyond them, but when he is on them, he would think about his brother Paulie, and he would think about, you know, his wife that passed. And as you get older, I don't even know how old you are, Dave, but
yeah, I'm getting close to 50.
Yeah. So you and I are, you know, we're in the same boat, and that's when you are in that age group, like we are, you start reflecting.
Yeah.
You know, I find myself reflecting a lot, and I find myself, you know, mindfulness is now like the big buzzword. And the truth is it's like, you know, you just get to a certain point in your life where you're like thinking more about what am I doing and, you know, what makes me happy. And exactly. So that's haunting.
Yeah, that's haunting. No, I agree. I think that makes total sense. You know, and you do think about that on the river. You're like, okay, even this year, you know, I talk about that sometimes, like, okay, we've got a limited amount of time to do some of these great trips, right? And there's thousands of them that we could do, but what are you going to do, you know? And then you got your family, you know, and how do you make sure you're doing as much with them as possible, right? There's all these struggles, and then you got the business.
Yeah.
It's kind of a crazy world. And then all of a sudden, you know, a friend dies at 50 of a heart attack, right? I mean, or something like that. And you're like, holy crap, that's actually stuff that happens.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that, you know, comparison is a great way to enter depression, in my opinion. Mm. You start comparing anything, comparing other people, comparing other lifestyles.
Right.
Whenever you get into comparison, you're pretty much knocking on the door of depression. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
but
right.
It's bad. Don't do it.
Yeah.
And,
right.
You know, wishing that you did something, you know, those are all things that I think I'm trying to touch upon this on my In the Scene podcast. And you probably are experiencing this too, Dave, is like, you want to go outside. You want to be outside. I enjoy being outside by myself. I really enjoy being outside with my family too,
yeah.
But I need some recharge time myself. But when I do go, I feel a little guilty.
Yeah.
But I'm different when I do it, and I do it effectively because I'm better. I'm just better holistically inside, and I'm a better person. But I got to deal with the stress of I'm going to leave my family for a little while, you know?
Yeah.
So I will tell you that I have deliberately like been observing my own emotions. And when I take my kids and my wife off grid with me, I do not experience the stress.
Mm.
I do not. I only deal with it when I'm not with them.
That's interesting.
And I've got the business. I got the business rolling enough for, you know, that it, I can separate. I can get away. You know, thank God I've been able to do that over the years, but now it's the leaving my family.
Who does that when you're gone on so you're gone for a week with the family, who's running the taking care of the emails and business?
Well, I mean, it's between Mark and, you know, Mark handling it and even just the understanding from an auto reply message that says you're away, you know, I mean, I can plan to get the rods out, tell people that I'm going to be gone. But, you know, Mark handles a lot of stuff. He's really great. So
today's episode is sponsored by Lake Lady Rods. You can reach Lake Lady right now at 218-251-2626. Check in with Chris and see what he has going. That's the best way to let him know that you're interested, or at least find out what kind of rods he has for you. I've got a fine-tuned specimen that I'm going to be breaking out here on the river this next week. A blue rod, a gunmetal reel seat, a sweet Portuguese handle, and it's got all the fixings, all the bells and whistles, including that nice jungle cock. This is a 9 foot four weight, and it just casts like a dream. I'm excited to be getting in on this one, and actually I might let the kids use this rod on this trip, even though they got a couple of fiberglass rods, which maybe we'll switch it up. Maybe I'll let the kids use the Chris's Lake Lady rod, and I'm going to use the fiberglass. I think we got we got the 8 footer, 7 footer, and 8 footer. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to break out the old fiberglass this trip. But if you want to check out what Chris has going, he also works on bamboo rods, builds those from scratch, all sorts of good stuff going there. You can check in with him right now at Lake Lady Rods. And the best thing, like I said earlier, is just give him a call. 218-251-2626. And if you can, this is the way to support this podcast. If you give Chris a call right there and just check in with him, pick his brain a little bit, ask him about rods, see what he has going. Would be awesome if we can get a bunch of people reaching out to Chris this week after this episode. Okay, back to the show. Let's dig into it. You know, we still got this small streams topic we want to dig into, so I don't want to miss that. But
I do this all the time. I go on a podcast and we end up talking more about life, you know. And
that's great, though. See, that's just you. You know what I mean? That's we didn't plan this at all, but that's the way you are. You kind of, that probably resonates with you. Anything you do,
it does. I think it's good to be honest with you. I think it's good to talk about it. I think, you know, there are younger anglers that haven't experienced this yet. There are other anglers that are our age that are dealing with it, there probably are older anglers that can say, oh yeah, I remember that, you know, it's so great now that I'm retired. Or maybe they say, I regret that I didn't do that one trip where I, you know, did a high mountain alpine lake golden trout trip or something, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, let's hear the podcast. We've been talking about this. This is In the Seam podcast. So how did, I'm not even sure how this came to be. Tell us about that. Why did you start a podcast?
Well, that was a COVID thing. It was me. I've always loved documentaries and stuff. I know, you know, like Ken Burns is like my idol.
Yeah,
and I wanted to do something that was a little bit more, you know, in depth and talking about stuff that, like, I like even the title suggests, right? And just like when you're fishing, we're looking for seams, right? Generally speaking, you know, we're looking for the things that aren't necessarily in the mainstream flow, than the edges. So the podcast has started to kind of get into that now, where I'm talking with people and asking them, like, what are these little tidbits that they come up with? And there are contradictory things, you know, some people have different opinions about conservation and about the use of the natural resources. And that's where the podcast is kind of going now. And I like it. You know, I like that it's not, there's plenty of podcasts to talk about places to fish.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that. There is. We got that, you know, I think you were on the Destination Angler was on Steve's podcast, right? And you guys dug into something. I mean, Steve covers, you know, destinations, obviously, and there is a lot of that out there. So that says, so you have this in, and how many episodes are you into? Is this kind of are you doing like once a week?
No, it was once a week. Now it's like once a month. So it's, I would say it's 10 to 12 a year. I got to bump that up. You know, if I want to, but to be honest with you, it's, I'm hoping, and I, the way I see it is when people see a new In the Seam episode, they listen to it because they're like, oh, it's a new one. You know, it's not like every week.
Yeah.
So I try to make everything count. You know, I try to, if I'm going to do it, I want to try to do it pretty well. And that's the idea with some of these episodes. So my recent one that I did with Keith Tidball, Dr. Keith Tidball from Cornell, we talked a lot about this entry reentry stress thing. We talked about Lewis and Clark and how that related to how we feel about entry and reentry. We talked about the use of the environment, what wild really is, what does wild feel like, look like. We talked about that because, you know, experiencing wildness with more people using the environment is different, you know, can be different, I guess. So,
right. That's good. Well, we'll put, obviously we'll have links in the show notes to that and people can check out your podcast. Always love getting, you know, hearing about a new one. So, well, let's dig into that topic. So we're going to talk small streams and you have some of your rods, you've got some specific gear for this. And I know you've talked about this before, but maybe we can just start there on the small stream. Let's just start with the gear right at the top, since that's kind of the hot, you know, topic here. You know, rods, obviously, you know, you have the rod. What is the, you know, for a small stream? We know small streams are, you know, everybody has a little bit different definition.
Well, you know, something,
yeah.
I'll get into the rods in a second, but I want to ask you a question. You know, what do you think about small stream fishing? Do you like it?
You know, I like all fishing, you know, I mean, still water, rivers, streams, creeks. I've done a lot more big water fishing, you know, just because I live near really big waters and streams, and I've, you know, I'm a steelhead fisherman. Like, that's what was not my first love, but it's something that's kept me going for a while. So I'm always thinking usually bigger water, but when I get a chance, and, you know, especially now with my kids, trying to get them more into it, I mean, small streams are appealing to me, right? More, but I haven't done a ton of it, to be honest with you. You know, I haven't done a ton of small stream fishing in my life.
So I think there's like an intimacy to fishing small streams because the environment is smaller and you can diagnose it faster. And, but also the environment can change quicker because you can go 100 yards and a lot can change in 100 yards in a small stream. And that density of, observation or impulse to me is like intoxicating. I really love that. And I find that I think more and more people really like that. And the reward from seeing a pocket or seeing a seam or just even a little bit more depth, and you're like, there should be a fish there. And then you plop a fly there and there's a fish there. That's fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's why, you know, a lot of people that I talk to that are like more in the business are like, you know, you really should branch out more into like saltwater and carp and warm water, right, and double-handed right. rods and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, you know, remember what I said a second ago, Dave, if I want to do something, I want to do something really well. Right.
Yeah.
There's a lot of rods that are being sold every day, and there are a lot of small short rods that are being sold every day. I'd rather capitalize and take that market share than try to reinvent it. Although I have rods that I've made, as I told you, I have history of making really good distance casting rods that won a lot of competitions and stuff. So we have this, we have a rod called the Coherence and the Coherence Plus, and they're great casting rods. The Peacemaker is a 10.5 foot four weight that also has an interchangeable piece. So you can turn it into an 8 foot three weight. So mm-hmm. it's actually five pieces in the tube. You know, that's a great rod, but, in the small stream lineup, they go from the Rockhopper, which is a 5 footer and a three weight. And that's a carbon rod. And I have a Muir, named after John Muir. That's an E-glass 7 foot, 3 weight, 5 piece. So that packs down to like 19 and a half inches. It's a great pack rod. We have the Beaver Meadow carbon and the Beaver Meadow S-glass. And the Beaver Meadow carbons, they start at 6.5 foot, 2 3-weight. So you can kind of like upline that rod and doesn't mind. And really, I like it better with a three actually, but some people like them crisper and they go with a two. And then the Beaver Meadow S glass is 6.5 foot, 2 weight, 6.5 3-weight, 7.5 3-weight, 7.5 4-weight, and 8 foot, 5 weight, which I believe we are now going to rename the Toad. And that is really going to be kind of like a bassy kind of bigger, bigger game kind of fly rod. And I've got some really cool graphics that we've made. Mark and I both, do you remember Frog and Toad? Remember those books, the Frog and Toad Adventures?
No, I don't. I have to check that out.
Oh, so I'll send you when Mark and I were growing up, we loved those books, and we had the little record player thing that you'd listen to.
Oh,
you
nice. Know? Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. I saw something on Jeff Kimball, too, Art. You got that going on out there.
Yes, Jeff. So Jeff Kimball, I can't forget Jeff. Yeah, so Jeff's an amazing artist. He's doing paintings on the blanks. He's an artist and taxidermist. And he's doing trout art painted right on the blanks.
Yeah, that's
it's
awesome.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's amazing. Really cool. And you don't see that. I mean, gosh, I guess it's funny because you see that trout art in other places, but are there, I don't think there's many fly rods doing it.
I don't think so. And yeah. I if they are, I don't want to put anybody down. It's probably a decal. I don't think that they have an artist painting it. We do.
Oh, so yours is actually painted. It's a painted.
I give him the blank. He paints it. He literally paints it with a paintbrush and airbrush. Yeah.
Then you just put a coat of epoxy over it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks a lot. So you got a mix of, I mean, really, but when you think of the people coming to you to get a rod, they are fishing, they're getting some for small streams.
Yeah, and they tend to have a quiver. You know, that's a cool, great thing too, is when you start to build a relationship with these customers, they, you know, our rods are affordable. You know, the Beaver Meadow Adams, for example, is $349, made here. I make most of them myself. So it's not hard for someone to get that one. And then they're like, oh, I'm going to get the Muir next. And then I'm going to get, you know, a Peacemaker. Yeah. And, you know,
who's rolling the blanks for you guys now?
Well, I don't disclose that, but I can tell you it is in the Pacific Northwest, and our suppliers are all in North America.
Yeah.
So all my checks get cashed in the USA, except our cork comes from Canada, cork makers in Canada.
But Berkheimer was
he was he's not right,
yeah
no,
at the start not. Gotcha. No, that's cool. That is awesome to hear. It's all basically U.S. well, North America gear.
Yeah.
Okay. So we got that. So we got the gear, the rods. So talk about that stream. So first, I guess let's go to the line. So you're talking pretty light stuff, two weighted. Is this all small stream fishing? Is this all pretty much floating line?
Yeah, I would say it is. You know, the Peacemaker and the Coherence are the longer rods. They can get into kind of like intermediate and sink tips and stuff. But I would say if a lot of people are fishing sink tips on small streams, I'd like to hear about it.
Yeah.
I think they're mostly using floating. So
yeah. Yeah. They might be doing some Euro stuff or something like that.
Yeah. Right.
Are you guys, and we had a recent episode where we had somebody talking about the Euro stuff on small streams as well, but you guys don't do any of the Euro nymph, the big longer.
The Peacemaker is the only Euro nymphing rod that you could use. It's to the 10.5 four weight.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. That is four weight. Yeah, I love that. Peacemaker is off of, obviously, is that is that the Clint Eastwood? Wasn't that a Clint Eastwood movie, Peacemaker?
So it's actually, it's a spinoff of Back to the Future.
Oh.
And we actually have an image of Marty McFly holding the Peacemaker gun in one hand and the Peacemaker fly rod in the other. And he's wearing his Clint Eastwood outfit, if you remember that.
That's right, that Back to the Future movie.
So,
that's awesome. So you got a double. You're hitting on Clint Eastwood and Marty McFly. So I'll get. We'll make sure to put a little snippet video of either Marty the Back to the Future.
I can send you the image. It's pretty.
Oh yeah, do that.
It's pretty cool. And Mark Usick and I are kind of movie junkies.
Oh, good. I love that. See, now you're hitting me. Now you're hitting me up because I love that. Although I don't watch as many movies now, back in like the 80s, 90s, whatever, right? I mean, I've pretty much watched everything. So we're right in the same. I'll hit you up with some of your top five movies before we get out of here.
Okay. I'm sure they're all going to be like Blues Brothers, Smokey and the Bandit type of stuff. Anyways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's great. All right, well, let's keep on the gear. Just so again, we're going to do a little bit of this. So we got the rod, we got the the line doesn't not critical there, and then reel, obviously same thing. Get something that's balanced. What else should we be thinking about? Somebody again. Well, first let's start before we dig into the general. Where are you at located now, and what's kind of your home area for small streams?
So I'm in upstate New York. So if you're familiar with New York State, there's like the Long Island, New York City kind of downstate portion. I'm upstate, so I'm smack dab between Syracuse and Albany, and I'm about 30 minutes from the Adirondack Park.
Oh, right. That's it.
So I'm in hill country. Yeah, I've got a lot of rivers. Really pretty place to live.
You're in a sweet spot, and you got plenty of small streams and lots of. Is that? I mean, are you? When you get out fishing, do you have kind of one spot? You're like, okay, this is my little spot for the day. Or are you always changing it up?
You gravitate towards your honey holes, kind of thing. But I do like to row boats and paddle, and I just got a couple of water masters and started kind of using those on some rivers that you would not want to do in a canoe, class 1, class 2 stuff. So that's kind of like been my latest thing, is trying to find those rivers. And I got 2 water masters, so my wife can go with me or Mark can go with me. And so I do like small stream fishing. I'll do that. I love to paddle. Things change as the seasons change, right? So in the spring it's like brook trout, and then that kind of converts over to the bigger water and brown trout and hitting the hatches and stuff, maybe go down the Delaware, maybe do some pond fishing for a big brook trout. And then water gets warmer, switch over to smallmouth, love smallmouth bass fishing, largemouth bass fishing, carp, even fall fish. I started to try to target fall fish. They're like, I don't even know if you know what they are, but they're like they're like a big minnow. And they get to be like 20 inches long. They're almost like a shad or a herring.
Oh, gotcha.
And they're viewed as like a trash fish. And I'm like, there are a lot of people in the United States that don't have a trout fishery, but they still have these small little mill creeks and stuff. And why can't they go catching other species of fish? So, so I've done that, rock bass and fall fish and stuff like that.
Gotcha. What are, for going back to the small stream type fishing, what are some of the misnomers when people say they haven't fished a lot of small streams, but they're the things that you hear about, but maybe aren't true? I think one of them might be size of fish, right? That they're all kind of tiny, tiny little fish.
Yeah. So it's all relative. I would tell you that I have a lot of stories and a lot of pictures of people catching fish that are in the high teens, even 20 inches out of small streams. They're definitely can be found. Generally speaking, they're smaller and there's a lot of them. And smaller again is relative, So if you go out with our Beaver Meadow, 2 weight and catch a bunch of 6-8 inch fish on a 2 weight rod, and the thing's flexing down to the cork.
Yeah.
It's a ball. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Then you get a 10-incher and you're like, holy shit, you know, like, oh, I got to get a picture of this guy, you know? And that's awesome. You know?
Yeah.
So it's, and again, you know, it's more about like how you feel, you know, how does it make you feel? It's not necessarily the fish is the end goal. It's going outside and having a good time.
Yeah.
And how you feel about doing that. So.
And probably not seeing maybe as many people in some of these areas. Is it easy to kind of get away from them?
That's very true. You know, I think I sold more fly rods over the pandemic. Well, I know I had record years, but generally people were like, I want to go to small streams because I want to get away from people. And that's true. You know, you hike into some of these places and you know, blue line, as they call it, or bushwhack, and you're not going to see anybody. You're not going to see trash. You're not going to see footprints. It's pretty fun. Really fun.
Yeah. If I was coming up to fish with you, say, you know, we're kind of in the summer now, you know, maybe September, would we have some action? Would it be easy to find some small streams and get some good action right now?
Yeah, we'd go for brook trout probably September. We would go in the Adirondacks and we'd go for brook trout, and you would probably sell your house.
Really? Why is brook trout that experience?
I'd say that tongue in cheek, because if you got me on steelhead, I probably, you know, could probably come to you. But
right.
Whether it's brook trout, cutthroats, even wild browns, wild rainbows, you know, when you're handling these fish in these places where the water's cold, a lot of oxygen, you know, wonderful ecosystem, and you hold these fish and they're like really just so pristine and untouched, and, you know, no marked fins, you know, no chip scales. It's just a great experience, and they're very colorful. You know, we have, our water is very tannic, so which is like a tea stain color, like brown stain colored water, and it really brings out the colors in these fish. It's kind of like contradictory to what you think, but as you know, you get fish that come out of the ocean or fish that are in really clear water, they tend to be more silver. And when they're in water and ecosystems that are darker, more mineral rich, they tend to get more vibrant in color.
More vibrant. So, and spotting and color, right? The spotting is amazing.
Right, right. So, you know, the, when I started Trout Power as an organization, our original mission statement was to honor clean water by the wild fish that live in it, not by its clarity. And the whole point of that was that if you had a glass of water that was tea stained from the Adirondack Mountains or Smokies or whatever, even the Everglades, right? And you hold it next to this, you know, beautiful, pristine glass of clear water and say to somebody, which one is more clean, right? More naturally clean. They say the clear one.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, this one's got trace chlorine and some other things in it. This one over here, however, that is a little tingy, right? That one's actually the better grade water.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to hit on Trout Power in a little bit here. I want to keep on this line of, where we're going, the Adirondacks. And so let's say I'm coming in September. We're going to pick up the two weight. I think it was the you had a couple of different ones. We'll talk more about that too. But I got the rod. I'm heading in with you. We're going to a undisclosed location. What's that look like as you're coming up to prepare for getting into these streams? Are we kind of crawling into these things, getting set up, or what's that look like? Like, picture your best place you could take me right now to get some action.
I would take a lesson from Mark Usick, and we would either put a fly box in our back pocket or just throw a bunch of flies on our brim of our hat. We'd have a pair of nippers and hemos around our neck and some tippet in our pocket. And I'd say, let's go. And that's what we would do. We'd have some streamers, we'd have some dry flies, maybe one nymph. And we would have a great day. We'd have a super great day. I generally like to wet wade whenever I can, because you actually you're using another sense and you can feel where there's springs and stuff like that. So we probably in September, we probably wear our wading boots and either pants or shorts. And we'd have a flask of bourbon, and we would have some smoked sausage and some cheese and an apple. And we would have a water purifier, and that's what we'd do.
That's it. That sounds pretty awesome. Yeah, you got, and drinking right out of the stream. So you don't drink out of the stream directly ever.
No, we have beavers, so yeah. You know, you get Giardia, and you're gonna lose some weight.
Not good. Yeah, I heard
that way.
I heard Yvon Chouinard, you know, Patagonia founder. He was talking about how he's over his whole life he's drank out of the streams, and he's, you know, he said he think that's what keeps him going strong.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, I know. Well, good. So yeah, it seems like, you know, the small stuff is maybe it's not rocket science, right? I mean, these fish, you're going to be in areas where they're not heavily pressured necessarily. You can hike away, get into some fresh fish. So yeah, pretty much that's it. Get out there, get a small rod, get some action. You know, what else do you tell somebody if they're coming in to pick up your rod and then they're heading out somewhere like this? Do you have any words of advice for them?
I would tell them to, again, focus on the experience. And I would judge your success based on the execution of getting outside, not, you know, how many fish you put in the creel or in the net or whatever you want to call it, how many fish you caught. You know, I would say that's how you should judge your success. So if you want to push yourself hard and you want to really go way in, then, you know, believe in yourself and do that. And if it's, you just want to like not go to the office, get outside and fish, then just accomplish that goal. That's what I would tell them. I wouldn't get into tips and tactics and mm-hmm. all that stuff, you know.
That's great. Love that. Perfect. Well, tell me about the Trout Power, because you have this sounds like nonprofit. I mean, there's a lot of things you could do, right? You could give money to Trout Unlimited, somebody like that, or some of these great groups, or you can start your own nonprofit. So why did you do that? Why did you feel like you needed to start Trout Power?
We worked actually with Trout Unlimited, and there was a consensus actually between, we talked directly with Chris Wood and told him we were going to do it. And, we were going to get into this genetic work, and we essentially told him we're going to do this project to do, microsatellite genetic work on brook trout to try to find more strains. And we literally told Chris, we're going to share all this stuff with you and share these protocols, and we're just going to dive into it, because the bureaucracy of kind of like getting it going at Trout Unlimited is going to take too long. And, so I was transparent about it and said, you know, look, we're freaking doing it. And, and he was like, go for it. And he, at the time, he kind of wanted a little bit of freshness to New York, the way New York and Trout Unlimited and upstate was being managed. So he thought it was actually, I think, a good disruption. And the reason that we did it, the reason that I wanted to do it, was to prove that anglers can do good science work. And the, I guess, epitome of science, right? When it comes to like biology and conservation and stuff, it's like, oh, imagine if you could do genetics. Like, you know, it's like one thing to be like, well, we're taking, you know, water samples and we're sending them to the lab. Well, that's cool. Yeah. But to say like, hey, Dave, we're going to go get some fin clips and we're going to put them in this little vial, and then we're going to send them out to get microsatellite genetic work to find out if, you know, if this is a new strain of brook trout, you're like, it's like, whoa, I am so in to this, you know, and that's what we found. It was very easy to get followers and get people excited about it, because it was challenging, it was new, and the reward, the self, you know, the reward that people got from doing this was very great.
Yeah,
they really enjoyed it.
How do you do it with? You know, I'm picturing some sort of event or volunteer training. I mean, how does that look? How do you get people out there doing this?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So we would make these, we would have these adventure weekends, and they would be up in the Adirondacks. They would be multiple nights, so it would be a lot of fun, you know, to do it. And we would teach the protocols. It would be the first thing we would teach the protocols on how to handle the, handle the utensils the proper way and not have cross contamination, how you'd keep track of your stuff. And then you'd be assigned a mission. So you'd have like 20 people at an event, and then they would be broken up into missions. So let's say you, Dave, you, Mark, you, Sick, you two have the option to take this mission to go way up this stream as far as you can. We believe there's a waterfall there. Try to go above that waterfall and get brook trout up there and get fin clips. Let's find out if the strain above the waterfall is different than the strain below.
Mm.
And that would be your mission. And you would try to catch enough fish and get enough fin clips so that statistically your data would be sound. Because just one or two clips isn't necessarily enough. Or if you got only got one or two clips, we ran the genetics on that and it looked like it was different, then we would have a bigger mission and go, okay, we need to get like 30 some odd clips here so that we're so our data is statistically sound. And everyone would be all in on that. So it was adventure weekends with mission based focus. And we would just bite at it, you know. You eat a whale one bite at a time, right? So every mission mattered. Everyone knew what they were doing. We would get the data back. It would all get mapped out, you know. And now the big dilemma is, what do you do with the data? Because initially, New York State recognized, you know, only a handful of brook trout strains. The science community knew we were going to find more. Now the collective database is like well over 80 strains of individual brook trout strains that we found in New York.
Hmm. And by strains, clarify that, because you've got brook trout, which are a species. How is the strain different from the brook trout species?
Right. So genetically, there are different attributes to the genome that can show that the strains are different. So just like you have the greenback, you know, cutthroat, and you have the Apache and stuff like that. Those are strains. So the same thing is true with brook trout. They don't necessarily look different though. Like, you know, cutthroats, you kind of can see the difference. Brook trout, you don't. So the main thing we were looking at was whether or not there was trace genetics from stocking.
Oh, right.
Okay. So we knew the genetics of this, what was called the Timiskaming hybrid strain that the state was stocking. So then we would look to see was the stock strain intermixing. Okay, were these fish crossbreeding? We would prove that, and we did prove that they would. We also proved that they can clean themselves out, so to speak. The strain can actually spawn out the stock strain. So if you leave them, believe it or not, the strong will survive, and you can recessively
give them enough time.
Right, give it enough time that they kind of clean the strain, cleans itself up. So all of these things were hypotheses, and then you know, good science is you have a hypothesis, then you prove it right or wrong.
Yep.
And so now I'm on this kick of actually, I'm not the president of Trout Power anymore, but I kind of advise them. And I am of the mindset that we should actually like personalize, or we should disclose these strains, because I believe that individual human beings will get passionate and get emotionally connected to their strain. A strain that they fish.
Yeah.
And then if you have an emotional connection to the strain, it's easier to preserve it and conserve it because you have advocacy.
Yeah.
So the state is a little funny on this. State is kind of like, I don't get it. Wild is wild. I'm like, why do we have to disclose these strains? It's going to complicate stuff. And I'm like, okay, we're talking about behavior here. Okay. Human behavior. We're not talking about management methods. Your management method is fine. You have, if it's designated wild, it's managed as wild, which means you're not going to stock there. That's fine. Good job. I'm talking about advocacy and preservation and getting human beings emotionally connected to want to protect that stream and keep that stream clean, have a stake in it. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that naming it, stupid as it sounds, you know,
yeah.
And it's like, if you have a pet, you know, like, you know, and the kids bring home some kitty cat, totally. Right? And then they name it and you're like, right.
Well, especially if you name, you know, give these, here's the way you do it with the human, let them name it. Then it's, right. You know, they'll call it their own name.
Absolutely right. Yes, it's a good point.
Today's episode is sponsored by Jackson Hole Fly Company. They've been designing and manufacturing fly fishing equipment and flies since 1978 in their home base in Wyoming. In 2020, they launched jhflyco.com and started selling gear directly online to anglers all over the country. You can go ahead and right now check out their huge selection of rods, reels, fly lines, tools, accessory. And right now, if you go to jhflyco.com/swing, you can get 25% off your first order. Just like Amazon, they'll ship everything directly to your door, saving you time and money. But unlike Amazon, you'll be supporting a great fly shop. and this podcast by simply grabbing a few products, maybe just a couple of flies. Check it out. There you go. Get free shipping right now. All orders over $50 and get that 25% off your first order. jhflyco.com/swing. Okay. Back to the show.
So basically, yeah, you're doing some work here that's showing there's more, I mean, essentially subspecies of these brook trout than people thought. Like you thought, you know, brook trout are wild, brook trout are wild, brook trout, but you're saying there's 80 different kind of strains or subspecies of these brook trout, which maybe look the same, but I mean, so that's the interesting thing, because with, like you said, with cutthroat, they all look a little bit different, right? I mean, and the rainbows too, there's different wild strains of rainbows. But I wonder on the brook trout, why? So it's just genetics. There's no other differentiating.
Well, I'm going to slightly let the cat out of the bag, because what Trout Power Now is doing is we're investing in genome analysis.
Oh, right, right.
So no one's done that.
Yeah.
And I will keep you tuned on that, but it's going to be pretty cool.
There you go. That's awesome. And where does the funding for Trout Power if somebody's listening now and they're really interested in this, maybe they're in your area, they want to help support this, how do they get involved?
They go to troutpower.org and they can give a donation that way. We're working on a thing right now where you actually can like buy a fin clip. So it costs anywhere from like $50 to $100 to do an analysis of a fin clip. Mm-hmm. So you can buy a clip. We're working on that right now, but it's all private. So we get a little bit of grant money, but not enough that it's, you know, it's mostly private. It's mostly people that are just, you know, giving funds. And it's kind of morbid, but kind of nice, I guess. I don't know. But we have had a number of people that have passed on and have left money to us.
There you go.
I never knew of that, but that's happened. A significant amount of money.
No kidding. How do they find you? How do these people find, you know, how does that work?
They know us, you know, either it started with the rod company or,
yeah,
you know,
right.
Whatever. It's through networking, but you know, we've made a pretty good splash in the Adirondacks and upstate New York media wise that we've done some cool stuff.
So, yeah, that's great. Who's the, you mentioned, we talked about your fly shop you had back in the day. Who's the local fly shop? Where do you go now?
We don't have one.
Or do you have, well, maybe that's not a great, maybe that's a hard question since you're
no, that's,
well,
okay. We need one, and yeah. We need one in the Utica Rome area. Mark and I have contemplated that, of getting back into that and having a fly shop again. So, there's like a Bass Pro Shops here, but that doesn't really count. So,
yeah,
you know, the closer ones are honestly, there's some in the Adirondacks. There's some in the Catskills. Yeah. You got to go a long way to get to a fly shop.
Really, you got to go along from where you are. You have to go quite a ways to find a local fly shop.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And that just seems like, yeah, it seems like you would think that's such a name you hear so much about that there would be fly shops everywhere, but that's not the case.
Right.
There you go. Right on. Well, this has been a fun chat. I've got a few more. I think we got a few random ones I've got for you if you're ready to take this out here in a bit. You're ready for that?
Shoot.
So we've got our own series of events we're doing, and we've got this challenge we're doing, the Top Flight Challenge. This is kind of a fun thing that I'll put a link in the show notes. We're kind of giving away a local guided trip, and basically to enter, you just have the people go to wetflyswing.com/topfly, enter their favorite fly, and they're entered to win this trip. We're giving away some flies as well. But so we didn't talk flies yet, and I know you're probably going to say this is not critical, but so you got your little box, like you said, with Mark, you're going out to the small stream. What are the two flies you're going to have? If you can only pick one or two flies, what are they?
Number one would be a muddler minnow, small muddler minnow.
How small?
12. And I might clip that and turn that into something else. And my second fly would be a fly called the Usual. And it's a fly that was invented by Fran Betters on the Au-Sable. Fran is passed. Yeah. So are you familiar with this fly?
No, but I'm familiar with the name.
Yeah, so he made the fly entirely out of snowshoe rabbit's foot.
Mm.
So it floats like a cork. You can trim it down and turn it into an emerger. It's easy to tie. So those would be my two flies.
That's it. And what would and what would Mark say if he had say one? What do you think he'd say?
It would be a streamer. He has this one streamer that he ties, and it is very effective. And it might rival the muddler, I would say. So if I had a If I had to add a third one, it would be a streamer tie by Mark Yusick.
Okay.
They're skimpy. There's just a skimpy good streamer.
Yeah, that's awesome. And smaller streamers, not gigantic streamers.
Right.
Relatively, yeah. All right, and we talked tips before we dig into tips, but give me a couple. Again, I'm coming up there. I'm going to be going out on my own into some tiny stream. What are the two tips you give me to make sure I have a successful day?
Your leader has a lot to do with how well you deliver a fly.
Mm-hmm.
So you should do some experimentation in the lawn with your leader and tippet length with the rod you're fishing before you fish. So that's the first thing I'm going to tell you. And you know how stout it should be and how long the tippet should be added onto it. That to me is important.
What if you have that muddler minnow you're on, say your 2-weight rod, whatever 6-foot, 6.5-foot 2-weight with a muddler minnow size 12, what's your leader look like?
I'd probably have a 7-foot leader tapered down to 4X.
Yeah, 4X. So pretty good. And nothing crazy there, just a standard.
Yeah, but I mean, again, this is where you got to play around, because if you trim back your leader, your basic leader, and then you add on 4X tippet, if you put on 3 feet of 4X tippet with your muddler versus 2 feet of 4X with your muddler, it's a lot different. Lots of times you get frustrated, and people get frustrated that they can't like get the fly to go where they want it to go. And a lot of times I find a lot of it has to do with they have the wrong tippet size based on the fly and too much tippet. I don't know how you feel, but lots of times people getting started, they're like throwing on, 3-4 feet of 5X with like a size 10 woolly bugger. And they're like,
yeah,
I can't get it there. And you're like, it's not your fault.
No,
well, let me show you something.
I love that.
This is physics. You just can't get the energy to go through that tippet, man.
No. And this question came up in our, I had an email that came out. We had a recent episode. I think it was last week. Hal Jansen, we were talking about Stillwater, and he was talking about how he fishes like a 2-weight almost exclusively fiberglass rods, like for everything, like including he's caught like, he was even saying like 15, 20 pound fish on a 2-weight. So it's this extreme thing. But I had a question from one of the listeners reached out to me and said, so how is he doing this? How is he turning over a big fly with a 2-weight rod? And so I sent the message to Hal to ask him, and he basically said he doesn't really turn the fly over. He just keeps with a long open loop, right? And that's how he does. Does that make sense to you? I mean, that's kind of was his take, yeah.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's everything really can be explained with physics, honestly. Everything from woodworking.
What if you failed physics or you got a D? What if you're really bad? Could you still understand this stuff?
Well, I mean, so there's basic principles, right? So it's like, it's all about transmission of energy with fly casting and a fly rod. And all you're doing is you're taking this lever and it has potential energy in it, in those fibers. Okay. When you flex it, okay, that's where you get that potential energy. And then that turns into kinetic energy when the energy comes out of the rod and throws the fly line. Okay. So there's a whole bunch of things that go through this to fly cast. And it really just comes down to the physics and all of these other factors of how, your arc and how fast you go and how fast you stop. And do you cushion it? Do you dampen it? All this other horseshit. Okay. The point is you just got to know that you are creating energy and you're trying to get the energy into the line and the line to the fly. So if you start observing these things by experimenting out in the lawn or casting a certain way and understanding what you can do casting wise to make the fly turn over and get the energy to get to the fly. And that's all you're thinking about is, am I getting the energy all the way to the end of the leader to the tippet? You will cast better. Okay. You have to, I mean, I know it's feel and stuff and I get it. And it is, it feels good when you cast because the energy transmission was efficient.
Right.
Okay. So
yep.
Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. That's efficiency. And so that's the thing. So if you're casting a tight loop with some setup and you're feeling it when your rod sets up and it's a great cast, you're like, oh, that felt good. Or like you're saying, you cast with an open loop, maybe your leader's a little bit light and you got a big fly on, but if you could keep that open loop, you can still get your timing quite right, however you do it, where you can still get the energy efficiently transferred, even with a big overweight,
sure.
Overweighted fly.
Right. I mean, you can cast your loops. You can be so efficient and your loop can be so tight that your top and bottom loop collapse on itself and you get a tailing loop.
Mm. All right. There you go.
So you can go what, and you know, in science and engineering, you call it boundary condition, right? So you can get to the boundary condition of open loop that's so open that it doesn't even have a loop and it doesn't cast that well, to the tightest loop where the top and the bottom are so tight, so close that they actually are not working that well. And they're and they're getting caught on each other, right?
That's amazing.
So if you can do that and you can understand what it takes to do both of those things, then you can find all of these variations in the middle to do what you want it to do.
That's crazy. Who, I can't remember, you might have said this at the start, but I mean, you had the doctor, you know, taking us full circle, the doctor that taught you how to fly cast. But, you know, how did you get up to a level? I mean, have you done, you know, worked with people that have got you to another level, or have you just kind of taught yourself over the years?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I had the fly shop, there was this guy, Bob Lewis, and he was a local teacher, great fly caster. He taught me and us at the shop a lot. So I would say the first person I ever worked with that was awesome and knew how to cast really well was Bob Lewis. After that, Steve Bouchard, who has, he has a rod company now too. Oh my God. So I met Steve when he was a pitcher at Lemoyne. So pitchers have this awesome muscle memory. Okay. So Steve was a great pitcher, great caster, because he could do stuff identically very easily. So enter me trying to make this rod. I give it to Steve. Steve's like a robot. So I can watch him cast it and he's casting it identically. And I can see how I want to change the taper, what I want to do. It was very symbiotic, very synergistic relationship. And then of course, you know, my technical brain is thinking about the physics side of things. So I learned more and more, and anybody can do this by learning how to not cast well, you know, trying to find these boundary conditions of casting short and doing things so that the rod, you can tell the rod what to do and it does it, even though it's not something that is good at casting, but you're doing it because you know you can tell the rod to do it. You know, when you can purposefully cast a tailing loop and then turn it off because you know how to do it, that's really, really good for learning.
Right. That's amazing. See, and that's probably not the problem a lot of, including me, that have that. I mean, usually it's like, well, you're doing a tailing loop and you're like, oh man, now what am I doing wrong? Like, why is that thing tailing on me? And I think you kind of said a little bit of it, right? Like literally your loop is too tight almost.
Yes. So I could tell you right now, if you go outside and you cast and you have your thumb up when you cast and you push the rod forward on your forward stroke, you push it and you don't tip it down a little bit, you will throw a tail. Okay, you do a real hard speed up and stop with your thumb up and you will throw a tailing loop. If you separate the top and the bottom a little bit by just tipping your thumb down, kind of like when you throw a dart and your thumbnail ends up pointing at where you threw the dart, if you're doing this with your hand right now, which I am, you can force yourself to throw a tail. When you can do that and you do this kind of punch push thing with your thumb up, you'll throw a tail. You will begin to understand how you threw a tailing loop.
Wow.
And then you'll understand separating the top and the bottom by just tipping it down a little bit. And, you know, you should have someone record you.
Yeah.
You know, you can do that so easily now.
Yep. Just get a phone, just record, just video.
Yeah. Doing yeah.
It. Yeah. Yeah. That's great. And then you could see it. That's a good idea. I'm definitely going to do that on the, maybe this week I'm going to be on the river. I'll get the kids out there. That'll be a nice little experiment with them. Get their cast outed. What are your kids? So how old are your kids there?
I have, Paisley is 3 and Parker is 6.
Yeah, 6. Yeah, 3 and 6. That's awesome. And how are you the type of dad that's like, oh man, they're going to be fly fishers, you know, come hell or high water? Are you kind of like, ah, no. If they get into it, they get
no.
into it?
Yeah, I learned from the fly shop that it usually skipped a generation and that the dads that were like pushing hard never had sons and daughters that fish with them. It was when they wanted to do it because dad did it or they liked the outside, it worked out really well. Many times, yeah. Like I said, it skipped a generation because the son hated fly fishing because their father pumped it on him so hard. And then their son saw grandpa doing it and then they want to go with grandpa, you know?
Yeah.
So it would skip.
Yeah, yeah.
I want my kids to be comfortable outside. That's outside. That's the main thing. You know, I want them to know how to light a fire. I want them to know how to, you know, run around consciously with bare feet, you know, because you could be stupid with bare feet too, right? So I mean, like all, you know, all those things. I want my kids to be comfortable with being outside. That's exposure.
That's number one. Yeah, that's great. Well, let's finish up. I was on a track. We talked tips. I just want to get one more resource just to wrap this up on small stream. So again, somebody, you know, they want to get into this. Maybe they don't know much about where could somebody go? Is there like, you know, kind of books, magazines, YouTube videos, fly shops? Where would somebody, could they dig in more on to learn about this?
There are a lot of books about fishing small streams, and there's a lot of videos and stuff on YouTube too. This is not for self promotion, okay? Mm-hmm. But I would say, like, if anyone listens to this and they have questions about small stream fishing and stuff like that, everyone is more than welcome to call me.
Yeah,
you know, I will take emails and stuff. I love to take emails. I really love to talk to people on the phone.
Perfect.
So,
we're going to try to blow up your number. What's the number to call?
It's on the website. It's
okay.
It's on there, but 315-580-3150.
Perfect. Perfect.
But it's, you know, jprossflyrods.com. But, you know, the main thing is I want people to know that, like, they can call and talk.
Yeah.
Chat.
No, I love that. That's way better than, I mean, books, sure. Yeah, books, all that is great. But yeah, there's nothing's going to beat talking to somebody or getting on the river with them, right?
Dave, I ship rods every day and my phone rings probably 10 times a week.
That's it. So that's amazing. So people are coming into your world. I mean, you specialize in the small stuff, the small rods. And where are these people coming from? Are they just through the, like...
They're all over the place. I got a chase after two. I got a rod going to Norway right now and a rod going to Australia that are stuck somewhere.
Is this a word of mouth thing or is this more like a Google thing?
I hope that it is both. You know, the analytics would show me that there is some stuff that I'm doing advertising wise that's pulling people in. But, you know, this today is going to be a big deal that I'm on your podcast. I thank you for that, by the way. I really am very appreciative. Because people can hear me and they can judge for themselves if I'm full of shit or if, you know, if they want to go and look. So
that's the power of, I think, the podcasting, right? It's such a cool, because they can, everybody listening right now can decide for themselves. They just heard an hour of you talking and I think it's been a pretty amazing hour. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I've never talked to you before and now I feel like I got a little insight onto what you're all about, right? So that's what this is all about. But let's take it out in the I'm not going to leave the movie on the table. The movie's on the table. So let's get into your top five or whatever. Give us some of your, so you got to pick, like, you know, you're going to sit down with some movies. What are your top? Give us a few.
Okay. So I mentioned Blues Brothers. So, it, you know, Blues Brothers.
Yeah. Well, what's his name? What's the big guy that passed away?
John Belushi.
And Belushi.
Yeah, Belushi. Yeah. Yeah, so it would be Blues Brothers. It would be Smokey and the Bandit. It definitely would be Mark and I would both put all, you know, Indiana Jones.
Oh yeah,
down there for sure.
Yeah. Yep.
And modern wise, you know, like I love like Daniel Craig in the new 007 movies. I think he's super awesome.
Oh cool.
You know, Guardians of the Galaxy. I think because it's got a twist on all the old music. I just love that one. You know. I get sentimental and I would listen, I'd watch like, On Golden Pond.
Yeah.
You know, I never like, I hated that movie when my parents would watch it. And now the drama, you know, the drama of the daughter and the father and the grandpa, you know, taking the kid out in the boat and they try to catch Walter.
Right.
I love that movie. Right. It makes me
the Fonda's. Right.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Henry Fonda and Jane Fonda.
Man, that was a good. Well, and I want to give a shout out Harrison Ford. He's a fly fisherman, I know, because I've been doing a little bit of research. We actually had Henry Winkler on a recent episode, and that was fun.
That's awesome.
So we got a few. We're working on the celebrity. So Harrison's on my list, and Indiana Jones, of course, is one of my favorites as well. So, all right, so we got some movies for you here. We'll throw some stuff in the show notes. And I also want to check on your podcast, since you're a podcaster. This might be a hard one for you, but not your top, you know, three or five favorite podcasts. But what's in your deck right now if you open up your podcast app? What were the last five you listened to?
So I'm not – I won't – I'm not going to promote any fly fishing stuff.
No.
Because I don't listen to it as much. But This American Life is what I model after. So, you know, Ira Glass is...
Oh, yeah.
The way I'm trying to do the In the Scene podcast now, really basing it off of This American Life and the style and the quality of that podcast. I think it's awesome. Mm-hmm. So that one's like by far at the top of my list. There are a lot of shitty ones.
What else have you listened to recently? What are a couple other ones you've listened to recently?
I have been listening to a lot of audiobooks.
Oh yeah.
Lately, to be honest with you, there's a book I didn't think I was going to like, and now I like it, and it's called Shop Class for the Soul.
Huh. Like Chicken Soup for the Soul sort of thing.
Well, it's this guy talking about how shop class as soul craft. That's what it's called.
Mm.
And he's talking about really like kind of like blue collar work and how working with your hands has changed and how good it is for you. And the guy really is a philosophy major, and it's a super great book. And I mean, I don't know. I can look at my podcast stuff. I've been listening to you. Mm-hmm. I've been listening to Meat Eater a little bit.
Uh-huh.
But it's kind of fallen out of love with that one, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, the Meat Eater. Yeah, Rennell, they're huge. But
it's just too much chatty stuff. Like, yeah, I'm going to listen to stuff. Like, that's why I find myself doing some audiobooks lately a little bit more, because I want to get like good conversation content. You know?
I know. How do you feel? How do you feel today? We're wrapping this thing up. How do you feel about our conversation today?
I hope it's good. I think it's good because, you know, we're talking a little bit more in depth about stuff. And I think that if you're going to listen to something for over an hour, then the density of thought in regards to the topic, you got to get a little bit like dirty about it. Like, yeah. You really got to get kind of down to the meat.
Yeah.
And keeping it at face value, like, you know, what's your, you know, where do you like to fish and what are some of your techniques? Like, you can engage somebody for maybe 10, 15 minutes on that.
Yeah.
But when you start talking about, like, you know, like we started to talk about reflecting on death.
Yeah. Where do we start this?
We start talking about reflecting on our own lives.
Oh, that's right.
And the stress of going outside and thinking about, you know, people that have died maybe and right. the haunted by water stuff.
Yeah. The haunted.
That's to me, that's maybe what a certain segment of people are going to want to listen to.
Yeah, I agree.
So
I agree. That's the feedback we hear. I think people love a little mix of it, but no, this has been awesome, man. I think you've done an awesome job, and I'm excited to keep in touch with you. I love that Mark is a good friend of yours, and yeah, we'll send everybody out to jprossflyrods.com if they have questions. And like we said, we're going to have a number in there for us. So if anybody has a small stream question, they can just call you directly and pick your brain if that sounds good.
That sounds absolutely great. We can talk offline if there's any kind of promotion stuff you want to do. You know, lots of times I'll offer like sticker packs and discount codes and stuff.
Cool.
It's your call. It's your podcast. We can talk about it. I often at work, I talk about discussion versus decision. So we'll have a discussion and you can decide, Dave.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. We'll put something, I'll just give a shout out. We'll put something good together. So we'll have people, they can check it out and they'll give a little incentive to give you a ring. And cool, JP. Well, thanks again for all your time and looking forward to keeping in touch with you.
Yeah. Thanks so much. And I would be great to fish with you someday. If you do come to the Northeast, we will gladly give you hospitality.
Yes, I definitely am going to hit you up on that. I'm slowly working my way around the country, North America. That's my goal. So I'm gonna hit that up. But cool, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, buddy.
So there it is. We are a go for a landing. Wetflyswing.com/358. 358 is going to get you those links. Everything we talked about today. You know it's good over there. I know you're loving it. And the work we have going is definitely second to none. Cheers to Dom. We are coming down and breaking through the Earth's atmosphere. Everything right now feels harder than those training days, but in a cool way, the power feels crazy good. Can't wait to land back on planet Earth. What's your travel story feel like? What do you have coming? Reach out to me and let me know, dave@wetflyswing.com. I'd love to hear where you're heading this summer, this fall, winter, spring. I want to hear what you have on tap. I would love to connect with you if you get a chance. dave@wetflyswing.com. We are going to be not only landing here, but we're going to be getting prepared for the next excursion, the next trip. We got a big one coming here, and it's going to be coming big time over to the Midwest. We're going to be doing a steelhead school. That's the big news coming up here. So check that out if you get a chance. You can ping me anytime, and I'll give you some information on that if you want to connect with me. I'm going to be fishing with Jeff Liskey. Jeff and I and the crew, we're going to have a great crew. We're going to be upping our spay game. If you ever wanted to up your spay game, have a good time, and have a chance at getting some steelhead action, Jeff explains it into a recent podcast he had, so this is going to be awesome. Can't wait to check it out. Hope to see you maybe at the school on the water. If not, check in with me online, and I hope you are having a good afternoon, a good evening, or a good morning, wherever you are in the world. Thanks for stopping in today.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.